Welcome to Authors on Tour Live, a weekly podcast for people who love to hear about books from the authors themselves. My name is Darren Fote, and today we are podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore, one of the premier independent bookstores in the nation, with three locations in the Metro Denver area. You can visit www.authorsontourlive.com for a complete list of upcoming podcasts. Wait a minute, it's time to begin.
Tonight's a real treat. One of the great storytellers, certainly of our times, is here. I'm so privileged to have him here from so far away. I'm reading the new book and loving it, and I think it touches upon so many of the things that Thomas has worked on in previous books, which is that deep love of and grasp of history and a mastery of the narrative form, which kind of combines in these amazing stories that give us a sense or a new sense of different periods of history, maybe from as told from a person that's maybe just one sidestep from maybe the biggest particulars, if you will. So just wonderful stories. I'm sure everyone here is familiar with his work. I mean, what is it? First book, back published book in 64, and there's over 45 plus published works out there. Many awards, both and much acclaim from both readers as well as critics. Most notably, was shortlisted for the Man Booker Prize 4 times, winning with Schindler's Ark. I guess we know it as Schindler's List here in the States. So many great things to know. So I'm thinking you all already have a great appreciation for him. So let me just bring up Thomas Keneally.
Well, thank you for coming out on such a savage night by Australian standards and for supporting your local bookstores so well. The Tattered Cover, I'm not a stranger at all to Colorado. I have behaved disgracefully many times in your mountains. I've fallen. There are little bits of my DNA out there, even on some green runs. And it's great to be back, even to fly in and see that peaked facade of the airport is a thrill. When it gets as cold as this in Sydney, television commentators speculate when winter will release its icy hold upon the city. I know you folk are warming up is the wrong term, but I know you folk are only warming up for extraordinary temperatures. Well, now, this book, The Daughters of Mars, came out of the fact that in my old age, I'm now 77, despite my uncanny resemblance to Brad Pitt. I've been writing these histories, social histories of Australia. Now, Australia has a wonderful social history because it's always been the dumping ground. If someone misbehaves, they go to Australia. It's our being founded as a purpose-designed penal colony was simply a form of this attitude to the place that it's where you send your undesirables. And since we're in a bookstore, let's say that that Dickens sent 2 sons there who weren't good at algebra and the classics, and Anthony Trollope sent 1, and they were all, at least in part, you could say that Australia destroyed them, or their father's illusion about Australia as a place where, as in Great Expectations, even a convict like Magwitch could make a fortune. Dickens' delusions were what destroyed them. And I love the paragraph in, or the statement in Line, in The Importance of Being Earnest, where Jack says to Algernon the wastrel, "Your uncle said at dinner last night that you have to choose between this world, the next world, or Australia." And I am perversely turned on by being the dregs of the earth. And I wanted to write a history of the oldest culture on earth, Aboriginality. And I wanted, over 100,000 years old, we now know. And I wanted to write about this being the trailer trash of the Southwest Pacific. When it came to writing about World War One, we've got an obsession about World War One because it was our first big game after Federation. We managed, unlike you, to federate without revolution, a country the size of the continental U.S., and with far-flung founding fathers, as Germaine Greer would rightly complain, there were no founding mothers, although the feminist organizations in the 19th century did do a deal with the founding fathers, that they, in their first parliament, they would give them the vote. The women's organization said, we'll support if you give us the vote. In 1902 that happened, and you know, since then there are some women who even don't vote the way their husbands tell them. Anyhow, we're subtly dissatisfied with having achieved nationhood without blood, and so we tend to concentrate on World War One. And there are even Gallipoli plays a considerable part in this book. That was a campaign when the British tried to capture Constantinople and an ice-free port through which the Tsar could be supplied. And they started south of Constantinople on the Gallipoli Peninsula. And the Australians were slaughtered there, so were the British, the Irish, everyone. It was a debacle. The general never left his ship. Can you imagine a general never visiting the battlefield from April till December? It was a preposterous campaign, but we've built it into this mythology, of course, and take it very seriously. And one of our prime ministers, Bob Hawke, was a fairly rough, brilliant character. He was a Rhodes Scholar. He went to Oxford, but he still sounded like a plumber. He said, not that there aren't scholarly plumbers, and if there are scholarly plumbers, then they're here tonight. Bob said when we won the America's Cup, this is the biggest Australian victory since Gallipoli. And an aide said, Prime Minister, we didn't win at Gallipoli. Oh, bugger me, I thought we did. Anyhow. So I came to looking at World War One and the mythic place it holds in the Australian imagination as the place where Australia was born, where we showed ourselves for the first time. Hardly anyone took any notice except the German machine gunners. But I decided I'd tell that the story of World War One, not in the triumphalist way, but via women's nurses, journals, stretcher bearers' journals, and surgeons' journals. And that's where Daughters of Mars came from. I found two things in particular that fascinated me. One was that these women really had to struggle for status. Nurses always have to struggle for status because there are surgeons who think that they're God, basically. I was thinking of a more witty way of putting it, but wit fails me, as so often. And then they had to struggle bitterly for status. So in one sense, it's a feminist drama, this book. And then one of the sisters could be destroyed by the struggle she makes against the hierarchy on the island of Lemnos to try to assert her status against the and her dignity against the authorities. That was first of all, that surprised me. Second, there was as an aspect of women that I find fascinating, and that is that let me tell the story. Now, years ago, I wrote an obscure book called To Asmara. It was about the Ethiopian-Eritrean War. Eritrea is to the north of Ethiopia, and during the Ethiopian famine, Mengistu, the Ethiopian dictator, was buying armaments from Russia. That's something they didn't tell us when we were donating. They didn't dare tell us that. And he was fighting a huge, largely unreported war. So I went there and wrote a piece for the New York Times Color magazine, and then I thought, this is something that should be a novel. So I was foolish enough to write a novel called To Asmara. And then when it was about to come out, an English television network said, if we give you a camera crew, will you go back in? It's great publicity for your book, you know, and for the fact that this war exists. And go in again and make a documentary. Well, it was very troublesome to go in. You had to go via the Sudan. You couldn't go in until a truck was ready. You had to pretend that you were going to some fishing village in the southeast corner of Sudan, whereas and you couldn't say you were going to Eritrea when the Sudanese police asked you. So that made it all uncomfortable for a neurotic like me too. But my wife insisted on coming on that second trip. So one night, while we're making the documentary, we always traveled at night because there was still, even though by this trip the Eritreans were beginning to win, there was still considerable bombing going on. And Antonovs. And you see Antonovs nearly every day. I never saw a MiG, but you see Antonovs come over, the bombers. And anyhow, middle of the night, because you had to travel by night, there is a group of nomads waving us down. And they were called the Hadarab nomads. They actually wander from southern Sudan, from Sudan, central Sudan, into Eritrea, and even sometimes into Ethiopia. And they follow the rain, as pastoral people do. And they had in a sling on the side of a camel a girl who'd trodden on a Russian landmine. And she was not only a dreadful mess, but her wounds were days old. So the smell and the extent of the damage wiped me out. I was sick. I was reduced to neurosis. I was never far from neurosis. And like most writers, I think. And so my wife, who back home, if my daughter's room were untidy, could turn into this avenging harpy, faced with this crisis, got out our big first aid kit, dressed some of the impossible damage that had been done to this child, and then we drove her like the girl, put her in the well of the Toyota and drove her to the Eritreans, dug into a cliff hospital at a place called the Rota, where Judy, with me and the sound man, still write-offs. Judy, my wife, not only did the sound for the sound man, but she acted as a scoutmaster in the theatre. And I thought, well, you know, there are some things that women are phenomenal at. And I noticed that these journals reminded me of it. The younger sister, Sally, in France, by the time they get to France, works in a casualty clearing station. Now, she's a girl, a woman in her early 20s. She is trained and worked in a country hospital. There's a map in the front that shows you where, and it's the town where my grandparents settled, so I know it well. As a matter of fact, the hospital Sally, the younger nurse, the younger sister works in, is a place where I was nursed for diphtheria when I was a little kid. I was just before diphtheria epidemics. So the resemblance to Brad Pitt is purely illusory. But in any case, it was astounding to me that Sally and her fellow nurses could process such a tide of damaged young men and do it over 2 days and two nights, each convoy. They would process a convoy containing, in many cases, injuries they'd never encountered before. Gas, which had withered and burned the linings of the esophagus and the lungs. All the women say in their journals that these were the most panicked of all the wounded, the men who had been afflicted with gas. And then, of course, frightful thoracic and abdominal wounds and amputations and shell shock, which they had not encountered in their civilian practice either. And so their capacity to process hundreds of young men aged between 17 and 25 over a few days and not go bad fascinated me. And characteristically, the only one who does suffer a collapse, she suffers a collapse from grief, and it's for her fiancé, who is an Australian officer. And he's been obliterated. Everyone knows he's been obliterated. But instead of accepting that, she concentrates on a letter he's carrying for her, from her. And her concern is that he's been picked up on the other side and a German orderly or doctor is reading her love letter and laughing at it. That's her concern, instead of accepting. But even as she's approaching nervous breakdown over the issue of her fiancé's death, she goes on nursing. And this capacity to do the world's washing up is always amazed me about children. In World War II, my father was away for 3 years in North Africa. He used to send me all this, all these Nazi memorabilia from North Africa. So when people say, why did someone from Australia write Schindler's List? Well, I was only 1 degree of separation from the Third Reich. Gee, now where was I? I was going somewhere coherent with that, and the coherency has abandoned me. I was therefore wanted to write about these women because those things impressed me about them. It was hard to be a strong woman then. Males were the super gender, to the extent that when they're torpedoed on a hospital ship called Archimedes, they're surprised when some of the men give up before they do, when some of the young men drift off raving in what passed in those days for life vests. I wish women were as one half of me, you know, the half that Germaine Greer and many a good feminist would chastise, wish we were still in such a our gender still had such repute. But women are fully awake up to us now, and they know we're weaker. But then men were supposed to be stronger, and it surprised them that they weren't. And the other thing is that Australians go on with this nonsense of one Australian was worth 10 POMs. That's what we call Englishmen. You call them Limeys. One Australian's worth 10 of those buggers. Well, he's not if he stands. There's no doubt the Australians were extraordinary troops and were probably overused, but they also suffered shell shock. They also suffered from gas. And if you were standing in a clump of 10 men amongst whom a high explosive shell fell, then your flesh was equally as vulnerable as any Englishman's. And so the terrible thing about this war was that we pretended it wasn't it didn't negate gallantry, but it did negate gallantry. A writer I like a lot is Pat Barker, and she writes about Englishmen with shell shock being treated by an anthropologist called Manning in a series of books. If you haven't read them, you'd enjoy them. They're utterly unexpected, but there are some famous poets in there who are suffered from shell shock in real life. One is Sir Cheverell Sitwell, one of the famous Sitwell family, and the other is Wilfred Owen, who would die, be killed by the war after being treated for shell shock. And all men were equally susceptible to that. If they were buried alive by a high explosive shell, then they often got, even though ultimately dug out, they often got shell shock. And the other thing was the landing of a high explosive shell. These two young women go to the war because they have connived on what they see partly as an act of love and partly as an act of murder. They have mercy killed their mother. Sally has stolen the morphine from the local hospital in this country town, and Naomi, as far as we know, injects it. And I was going to read, and I'm sure I can find it. This happens to all traveling writers, I think. I keep on giving away my copy because a student comes up and says he can't afford it, little con artist, and you end up giving him your book, you know, with all saying, you actually say, I'm sorry, it's dog-eared, you know. It's only later you realize you've been had, or part had. But anyhow, if they're young and they want a book, God bless them. So the mother has died in this country house in the place called the Maclay Valley in New South Wales, about 300 miles north of Sydney. And these two sisters, it appears, have connived on it. And they depend on the slapdash attitude towards death certificates of the local doctor, Dr. Maddox. That Saturday morning, Dr. Maddox came to lower his face over Mrs. Jorrance and to ask Naomi about the last injection and how many grains, and to accept what she said, and then to breathe, good woman, good poor woman. Then he prepared a medical certificate, which he showed Naomi and Sally, and which said that Mrs. Jorrance had died of cancer, nephritis, and exinanition. Well, exinanition is a tautology in a death certificate because it means a failure of all the systems. So, of course, all your systems have failed. You're dead. But I went through the Maclay Valley's death certificates, and both my grandparents were listed as dying of nephritis and exinanition. And I went through a number of others of their generation, and they're all nephritis and exinanition. I was able to get hold of them through the local pharmacist drugstore that's been there since 1855. He also showed me from the medical record which doctors were drug addicts and so on. Very interesting. But that's in an earlier book called The River Town, an earlier obscure book. This Dr. Maddox is in this obscure book now. There were in the valley many people Dr. Maddox had certified as dying of nephritis and exinanition. Nephritis and exinanition was the cited verdict all along both banks of the river and inland to the blue wooded hills where the timber workers camped and always died of nephritis and exinanition unless a tree fell on them. Farmers who had taken poison to escape the bank had their death certificates compassionately marked by Maddox with that saving formula. So their desire to become war nurses is based on that, in a considerable part, on the unconscious desire to place their mother's death in the context of so many damaged and harmed young men. They have no idea how large the volume of harmed will be. And hence, unknown to each other, they both volunteer and, to each other's horror, find themselves on the same transport that all the nurses travel on, going to Egypt. Egypt is where they end up. And of course, another motivation for the Australians was to see the big world. In this book, when they're on their ship and they cross the equator, I say, and I don't know why I should come up with such a neat phrase, I didn't think I was capable of it, but I say they passed the line between the world of the colonists and the colonized and the world of the owners. And of course, Britain then and France and Russia and Germany were the owners of the world, and Italy. You just had to look at the map of Africa to see who owned the world. They are astonished from the beginning how cheek by jowl both the cultural wonders and the horrors of the Northern Hemisphere are. They're very close. They're astonished when they see the pyramids. They take over a place called Mena House, which is still a hotel, I think, near the pyramids. But it was a hospital in World War One and World War Two. Actually, my father was treated there, and he not for something disrespectable either. You can see, from this grove, from this oasis of Mena, the pyramids right there. And if you come from Hicksville, New South Wales, you think, are they really there? Could they possibly be there? The wonders you see in those encyclopedias when you're a little kid, you don't quite believe they exist. And the women don't quite believe that they can approach these wonders on normal feet, that they must have to have some other means of propulsion to get there. And then between the pyramids and Gallipoli, it's a few days. It gets worse in France. Between the glories of the Louvre Museum and the Salon d'Automne and the Impressionists and the Eiffel Tower and Notre Dame and all the rest of it, it's only about 70 miles from there to the gas-impregnated, body part-impregnated, rat-impregnated trenches. And that's something that runs through the book too, a sense of new world astonishment at both the glories and the horrors. I'm sure many an American felt that too when America entered the war, that Europe had a very crowded in violence, and it was very close to all the wonderful things like Rouen Cathedral. And it impresses a young infantry man called Condon, who wants to be a painter, and he encounters the Impressionists. And he very endearingly says, look, these people, these phenomenal people, these prophets of art, are sunk up here in the northern gloom of Europe. But this is where the talent is, and they make the best they can with the light they have. And then down in Australia, we've got all the light and none of the talent. If we could just get them together. that's the sort of thing that many people think in this book. But that he's also the one who says, I can't understand why the trenches are so close. He introduces her to Delacroix, who's one of his favorite artists, and he takes her to the Salon du Temps to see her first impressionists. And, you know, why is it just a bus ride from the first impressionists to the trenches? A few plot lines, I suppose, before we have questions. Because she stands up for her sisters on Gallipoli, on Lemnos, the island of Lemnos, particularly for a woman who is found, who becomes rather infatuated with a blind officer and an Australian officer, and they're found sitting on the floor one night in a darkened ward, sharing a chocolate. You know, an absolute apogee of promiscuousness. And she is put in the psychiatric compound. And there was such a woman. These things happened. Even though the novel is a novel and most of it is lies, it's all stolen from nurses' journals. And when Naomi breaks into the compound and visits her, Naomi's career has ended and she's put on a ship back to Australia. It's not a happy ship, because in World War I and World War II, the first casualties of war until antibiotics were discovered were the casualties of Venus. You know, you get somewhere strange and glamorous you've never been before. Somewhere you get drunk, the older men take you to a brothel for your initiation, and you get syphilis, which is intractable in those days, and which shadows what's left of your life forever. And so the first men these women have to treat are the syphilis cases. And there is a syphilis ghetto on returning troop ships, and men begin to suicide rather than face their mothers, wives, sisters, girlfriends, and so on. And the shell shock begin to suicide, and the men who have lost faces begin to suicide. So it becomes a ship of suicides. There were such ships, and Naomi has to deal with that. She does get back to France with the help of a one-legged amputee matron from Tasmania called Matron Michie. And again, Matron Michie's a woman who really knows how to stand up to guys. And in those days, that it was hard to stand up to them. So again, she has a place in this book. And she and Naomi end up working for an eccentric English noblewoman who's based on a real woman. I've got to let you ask questions here. Oh, no, we only started half an hour ago. That's good. I've got more ear-bashing time left. So in this book, there's a woman in Australia that I love utterly platonically, and her name is Rachel Ward, and she's an actor, as we feminists correctly say now, and she is born of a noble family called the Dudleys, who've been either being beheaded or acquiring real estate since the Elizabethan age. And they're titled. There's a Lord Dudley. And Rachel Ward was in a mini-series, I think the Thornbirds, with a friend of mine, a really rough bloke, highly intelligent. He pretends to be rougher than he is, but he's pretty much a far more characteristic Australian than I can ever manage to be. You know, anyhow, I won't tell you the stories that we've been involved in. But To get revenge on her parents, Rachel Ward fell in love with Brian Brown, a quintessential Australian. If you have anything against your parents, it's the ultimate vengeance. And she came to Australia, and she's wonderful. And one day she said to me, I had this great-grandmother, Lady Dudley, she's called Lady Tarleton in the book, who founded the Bush Nursing Service. Now, this was a service that was still in existence when I was young, and it sent nurses into remote communities to help women remotely placed give birth. It was like a version of the Flying Doctor, actually, before there were aircraft. And Rachel Ward's great-granny founded this organization in Australia when she was there before World War I. And then she decided at the start of the war that she was going to found an Australian hospital at Boulogne. No one wanted it to. She was considered a raging eccentric. She is very beautiful, she like Rachel, and she was very effective but slightly eccentric. She actually she reminds me very much of Oscar Wilde's mum, Speranza. If you should read something about Oscar Wilde's mother, if you got to get a chance, she was absolute glorious loony, but effective. God, effective, and her mind on the right side of politics. I won't say what side that is in case I offend you. But anyhow, Lady Tarleton founded, Lady Dudley as she was, founds in this book, the Australian Voluntary Hospital in Boulogne. And the establishment looked down upon that hospital so that everyone that works there is under suspicion. But it's a perfectly operating hospital, hospitals at which Lady Dudley or Lady Tarleton in the book manages. And I give her a lover in the book because I think she deserves one with a husband like she has. By then she's estranged from her husband, so it's perfectly okay for her to have a lover. And he's a surgeon and a pathologist who's researching what is in nurses, surgeons, and orderlies' throats. The big argument, are masks necessary, was still raging. And of course, the old school of surgeons said, oh God, it's rubbish, you know, there's no way you need masks. And he's trying to prove you do. So that is something that I write about, not because I hold a candle for the English aristocracy, but because she existed, and again, she passed the test. She was troublesome to men. Now, I sound as if I like women being troublesome to me. I don't like them being troublesome to me, but I approve of the concept in general. I approve of them being troublesome to all the males in this. Turbulent, creatively impudent, whatever you want to call it. That's because I've got daughters. And I have a granddaughter who you should watch out for, because not only is she an Australian, her father's American, and she's an American citizen. So she could be your senator one day, and then you'll know it. Anyhow, the novel, the climax of the novel, is that terrible Spanish influenza that affected the young in particular. You know, they talk about pneumonia and influenza as the old person's friend, some bloody friend, you know. But it was phenomenal that influenza attacked the young, and particularly if the young were a bit run down, like nurses were, and so on. Every day, I live on the North Head of Sydney, and North Head of Sydney is a national park, and there are wonderful walks through it, through this, what they call Headland Heath. And in the middle of this walk, there is an old cemetery that belonged to the quarantine station. It's just down the cliff, where people were put if a ship arrived with any infectious disease upon it. And they were kept there 40 days, hence quarantine. There is in this cemetery a woman called Ellen Kenny, a 27-year-old nurse, who died died of Spanish influenza while nursing soldiers who had brought Spanish influenza all the way from France to Sydney. And that's why I knew as soon as I decided to write this book about women she's not mentioned in the book or even in the credits, but she is the guiding spirit to an extent of this book. And I feel I kind of know her, because with a name like Ellen Kenny, that's a very Irish name, and I'm of Irish descent, and we sort of, Ellen and I get on well, and we know where each is coming from, and God bless her. That more or less covers what this book is about. So falling short of an on-the-knees pleading that you should read it, even above buying it, read it. Falling short of pleading, I think I'll let it go at that. Thank you.
That's all for tonight's Author on Tour. I'm Darren Fote, and we have been podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore in Denver, Colorado. Stay pod-tuned in the coming weeks as we podcast Authors on Tour.